My unusual greetings to all the comrades present here, youngsters, students, faculty. I have prepared a paper on this issue and I will read some parts of the paper and make some elaboration. The paper will be distributed to all the members of audience in the end, I guess. So I will start by reading the paper and at right places I will make some elaborations and some comments. The title of the paper is Caste Question, Marxism and the Political Legacy of B.R. Ambedkar. It would be purely tautological to claim that caste is one of the essential characteristic features of Indian social reality. However, at the risk of being tautological, I must begin by reiterating this oft-repeated cliché. One of the reasons for that is the recent incidents that shook the conscience of every justice-loving citizen of India and underlined the question of caste with renewed urgency. The institutional murder of Rohit Vemmala and some other Dalit students in universities across India, the Jat, Maratha and Patel education for reservation, Una incident and an unprecedented spurt in the anti-Dalit atrocities. All these incidents have brought the question of annihilation of caste to the center with reinvigorated imminence, though it was never on the periphery. Undoubtedly, any discussion of a radical and revolutionary transformation of Indian society must deal with the question of caste. Now, it would be a sheer act of self-suggestion if we assume that we are the first ones to attempt to understand the question of caste and its annihilation. Anti-caste movements and anti-caste warriors for centuries have tried to understand caste and have fought against it. Any attempt to understand caste must evaluate these anti-caste movements and anti-caste warriors like Iyengar, Phule, Periyar, Ambedkar and many more. As Marx had once said, to be a radical means going to the root of things. And Ambedkar also said that jab tak jao vivad mitega in Hindi. In English, go to the roots and the conflict will be resolved. This also holds true in understanding caste system, the positives and negatives of anti-caste movements of past, and proposing the possible path of annihilation of caste today. In other words, to paraphrase Lenin, we must begin with the beginning. The first question that we must answer is one that has been answered a zillion times by myriad kinds of people, including activists, thinkers, academicians and philosophers. What is caste? I would humbly attempt to present a Marxist understanding of caste in brief, and in the process I would make some critical comments on some of the major interpretations of caste system too. To answer the question, what is caste? We must answer the question, how did Varna caste system originate? In my opinion, to understand caste system in its contemporaneity, it is essential to comprehend it historically. One of the main weaknesses of sociological studies of caste is their disdain for a historical view. The positivistic fetish to record the myriad contemporary particularities of caste prevents most of the sociological studies to arrive at a balanced historical understanding of caste system. Therefore, I deem it essential to begin with the question of origin in order to develop a rigorous understanding. Now, this question itself can be subject of a long dedicated discussion, but I shall try to present my understanding of the origin of caste system or the Varna caste system in very brief, and in this I would mostly be following the leading historians, sociologists and anthropologists who have probed this question while trying to synthesize their conclusions. Varna caste system came into existence in the later Vedic period in the northwestern part of the Indian subcontinent. And then it slowly expanded into the mid-Gangetic plains towards the end of the last millennium and the beginning of the new millennium. Not last millennium, the first millennium after Christ's birth. It, in a gradual process, caste system enveloped different parts of Indian subcontinent in varied forms. This process continued till the early medieval period. If we look at the history of Varna system or the Varnashram, we find the first reference of the word Varna in the 10th mandal of Purushasukta of Rigveda. This particular section of Rigveda, it belongs to the later part of the early Vedic period. I mean, the Vedic period is divided into two parts, early Vedic period and the later Vedic period. The early Vedic period is the period of Rigveda, when the hymns of Rigveda were created. And the early Vedic period itself has been divided into two parts, the early part of the early Vedic period and the latter part of the early Vedic period. The first reference of Varna appears in the 10th mandal of Purushasukta, which belongs to the latter part of early Vedic period. Now, in the first reference, what the description of Varna that we find is very peculiar. I mean, we don't find the three basic characteristics of modern caste system in the first description of Varna: hereditary labor division, caste endogamy, and untouchability. These three characteristic features of modern caste system are not found in the first description. And in other sources of the same period and the period following that, we find there was considerable internal mobility within the Varna system. The description of in this first reference of Varna, it resembles more of an embryonic class division and labor division. And various historians have studied this. For example, D.D. Kosambi, Romila Thapar, R.S. Sharma, Subira Jaiswal. Though there are internal contradictions in their interpretations of this first reference, but all of them agree that the first reference of Varnashrama in the Purushasukta describes the class division of the later period of the early Vedic society, towards the end of early Vedic society. The first reference of Jati, now everybody knows that Jati is a different concept from Varna. As Ambedkar himself then said, that Varna was more like a state system of Europe. It was like a social estates, graded system of a social estate. But the proliferation of caste happens later. Reference to Jati or caste, it occurs in Ashtadhyayi of Panini, which belongs to 200 BC. Ashtadhyayi of Pani and Brihat Samhita of Varahamihira, and also in Yajnavalkya Smriti. All of these sources belong to around 200 BC. But in these sources, Jati and Varna have been used interchangeably. Only in one place, in Yajnavalkya Smriti, Jati and Varna have been used differently, conveying different meanings. So till 200 BC, the divergence between these two concepts, Jati and Varna, had not taken place. This much is clear from the evidence that in the Rig Vedic period, the Varna system was signifying an embryonic class division and labor division. In other words, at the time of origin, Varna division was the class division of early Vedic society, as Kosambi has rightly pointed out. Now, the historical materialist interpretation of ancient Indian history in proper started with D.D. Kosambi. According to D.D. Kosambi, there were many waves of Aryans who migrated to India. And he broadly divides these waves into two: the pre-Vedic Aryans and the Vedic Aryans. The pre-Vedic Aryans had come to India around 1900-1800 BC. And they got settled in the northwestern portion of India, and they got mixed up with the original inhabitants of the land, which also included some surviving elements of the Harappan civilization. When the Vedic Aryans came around 1600-1500 BC, they clashed with the already settled Aryans. The terms that they used for these already settled Aryans who had got mixed up with the aboriginal population of this region. The terms that they use for them, in Rig Veda we find reference of these terms, is Das, Dasyu or Asur. Now in the first references of these terms, the meaning of these terms is not the meaning that these terms assumed later. I mean, in those references, Das didn't mean slave, Asur didn't mean demon, and Dasyu didn't mean plunderers. These were the meanings that these terms later assumed when the pre-Vedic Aryan tribes had been conquered and subjugated by the Vedic Aryans. Then these terms changed their meaning. For example, you find many references in which Asura has been used for Indra also. Now Indra is the main deity of Rig Vedic Aryan people, and almost one third of references to any god pertains to Indra. Indra has been described as Purandar, which means destroyer of cities. He has been described as Asura. And there were two terms used for different kinds of gods. For this worldly gods, Rig Veda uses the term Asura, and for the other worldly gods like Varuna, they use the term Deva. But later the meanings change, and as soon as these pre-Vedic Aryan tribes are subjugated, defeated and vanquished, the term used for them became Das, and the Das word, this word, assumed its modern meaning, which is slave. Asura means assumed its new meaning, which is a demon, and Dasyu assumed its new meaning, which is a plunderer. So in this transition or the changing meanings of these terms, they actually reflect the process in which the Vedic civilization conquered the pre-Vedic Aryans who had got mixed up with the original inhabitants of the land, including surviving elements of Harappan civilization. And this shows how the Vedic society came into being, in a way. Secondly, when the Vedic Aryans came, they were mainly pastoral nomadic people, and they practiced very rudimentary forms of agriculture, almost none of agriculture, very rudimentary and very scattered agriculture. But they were divided in three parts. And there is a famous historian of religion, Bruce Lincoln. He has given a theory that almost all the pastoral nomadic people had a tripartite social division, which was a kind of pre-class social stratification in which there was a class of warriors, there was a class of priests, and there was a class of common labor population. In Rig Veda, for them, the terms that have been used is Brahmanya for priest class, Rajanya for the warrior class, and Vish for the general laboring population. When the pre-Vedic Aryans had been totally subjugated, they invented a new term for them, which was Shudra. And that's how the Varna of Shudra came into being. With the emergence of Shudra Varna, the Vedic society organized itself into the fourfold Varna division, and that's how Varna system came into being. And the first reference comes towards the end of Rig Veda, which we talked about in the Purush Sutra, which talks about four varnas: Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas and Shudras. Now, according to R.S. Sharma, another historian who builds upon the theories presented by D.D. Goswami, he says, before the advent of iron, use of iron towards 9th century, 8th century BC, and the use of iron led to clearing of forests in the mid-Gangetic plain, which was covered by very dense forests. With the advent of iron, clearing of forests started, the Vedic civilization expanded eastwards, and in the process of expanding eastwards, two things happened. One, surplus production increased to such an extent that class formation and state formation was possible. Second, in the process of eastward expansion, the Vedic civilization assimilated many tribes through violent and non-violent process. D.D. Goswami and R.S. Sharma agree that the vanquished tribes were assimilated as lower castes, and that's how proliferation of castes started. These vanquished tribes, they were settled in the Shudra Varna as new castes. Some of the tribes which assimilated in non-violent process, their priest class got assimilated as new castes within the Brahman Varna. The warriors in the tribe, they got assimilated as new castes within the Kshatriya Varna. So there was a differential kind of assimilation. According to R.S. Sharma, before the advent of iron, this Varna system, this fourfold division, which finds the mention in Purushottam, it represents a pre-class social stratification. He calls it non-monetary peasant society, R.S. Sharma. So it's a pre-class social stratification. But with the advent of iron, surplus production, class formation, and state formation, these social strata get consolidated into class, and a proper Varna society came into existence. We won't go in the debate between R.S. Sharma, Suvira Jaiswal, Romila Thapar, Iravati Karve. For example, Romila Thapar and Iravati Karve say that Harappan civilization already had something like a caste system. The Vedic Aryans who came to India towards 1600 BC, they didn't have any kind of Varna or caste organization. And it was only through interaction with the surviving elements of Harappan civilization that caste system developed. But this theory is not supported by archaeological and literary evidence. And Suvira Jaiswal has effectively refuted this argument on two planes. One is, there is no evidence for that. And second, if you say that it was the Harappan civilization which is the main culprit for emergence of caste system, then caste system becomes something peculiar to Indian subcontinent. It becomes a particular characteristic of the Indian subcontinent. When the Vedic Aryans came, they got contaminated by this tradition of caste system of Harappan civilization. Anyway, between 500 BC, the end of the Vedic period, and the beginning of the period of tribal republics, from 500 BC up till 1st century AD, which is the period of 16 ancient tribal republic as well as the Mauryan Empire, during this period, castes proliferated in a much rapid fashion. Many new tribes were assimilated into the Vedic society. And in this process, certain castes, vanquished castes, were assimilated into Vedic society as the Pancham Varna. Those castes who fall outside the fourfold division of Brahman, Kshatriya, Vaishya, and Shudra. And this Pancham Varna later constituted the outcast. But untouchability did not originate immediately. We find in some of the sources that the Brahmins started to make a distinction between Heen Shudra and Aheen Shudra. Heen means lowly. So Heen Shudra and Aheen Shudra. And there was a sense of repulsion and a sense of pollution expressed toward Heen Shudra and the outcast. But untouchability was not there at that time. Untouchability emerged with the emergence of feudal mode of production with the Gupta Empire in North India. During this period, a change occurs in the Varna system. The main occupation of the Shudras before 500 BC was supply of servile and slave labor. The Brahman and Kshatriya combined to form the ruling class. The Vaishyas were the main agricultural population. Agriculture was the main occupation of Vaishyas originally, according to the Brahmin Samhitas and the Vedas and all these ancient sources. And the Shudras were kind of, they were, if you are aware with the slavery in ancient Greco-Roman society, they were more like helots type slaves who supplied servile labor and also slave labor. But this changes during 500 BC and 1st century AD when Shudras become the main agricultural caste and Vaishyas transfer to trade. They become the main trading world. Now why this change happened in the caste hierarchy, even going against the earliest ritualistic codes and religious codes which prescribed agriculture for Vaishya, which prescribed priesthood for Brahmins, and which prescribed warcraft and statecraft for Kshatriya. This changed. Though it was written the other way round in earlier Vedic texts, but this changes and Vaishya become the main trading world and Shudra become the main agriculture world. The reason for that was the changes in the socio-economic context. From 500 BC to the end of Mauryan period, It was also the period of the second urban revolution in the Indian subcontinent. The first urban revolution was during the Harappan period, and the second urban revolution belongs to this period, when agricultural surplus, much more consolidated, construction of state apparatus. So this period, in this period, the political economy of society changes, the production relations and the mode of production changes, and with these changes, the ritualistic hierarchy also is shaken. It's not changes, but it was shaken. The Shudra who supplied servile labor became a class of semi-free and free peasantry. That was the origin of the, we can say, the middle peasant caste, the upsurge of those castes that we are witnessing after the Green Revolution. The seeds of that were sown in 500 BC and between 500 BC and 1st century AD. This change in the Varna hierarchy, this proliferation of caste, this creation of a new population of outcasts, the vanquished tribes who had been assimilated as outcasts, these changes in the Varna hierarchy, they actually reflect the socio-economic changes in the society of that time. The beginning of Gupta period was also marked by emergence of feudal production relations. This was marked by the beginning of land grants. Before Gupta period, we don't find means of payment or main form of wealth as land. But in Gupta period, the principal means of wealth and means of payment becomes land. Before Gupta period, it was mainly cattle stock, other things and commodities, and only secondary land. But in Gupta period, land becomes the principal mode of wealth. There was a process of ruralization of economy, demonetization. Unlike this Modi's demonetization, there was a demonetization at that time, decline of urban centers, and this was accompanied by land grants. So the Brahmins also started to be paid in form of land. So state and rulers and jajman, I don't know what is the term for is jajman used here also. Those who pay the Brahmins for their priestly services are called yajnavan. Those who hold and finance the yajna are called jajman in North India. So the jajmans, the rulers, the kshatriya, the kings, they started to pay Brahmins in land. And this witnessed the rise of Brahminas as a landlord class. We witness, but if you read the early Brahmin samhitas and Vedic sources, it was prohibited for Brahmins to take their payment in land. It was allowed for Brahmins only to take gifts in things and living in alms, dan dakshina. So the Brahmins started taking land, emerged as a landlord class. And in this process, those Brahmins who were still living on alms, who didn't take land, they were downgraded in the caste hierarchy. And if you read Declan Quigley, he is a sociologist. He has written a very good book on caste. It's called The Interpretation of Caste. He talks about emergence of an untouchable Brahmin caste in North India. Those Brahmins who kept taking alms, kept taking gift of things and lived on that, and could not emerge as a landlord class. They were downgraded in the caste hierarchy. Still in North India, if you go to certain villages, those Brahmins are called Mangan Brahmin. Mangan means beggar. Those Brahmins who beg. So these Brahmins living on alms, they were downgraded in the caste hierarchy, world hierarchy. And the landlord Brahmin, which was prohibited for Brahmins in the earlier period, they emerged as a dominant caste. So again, we witness a change in caste hierarchy, in the Varna hierarchy, due to changes in the socio-economic relation. The point that I want to make, that to understand the relation between caste and class, it is essential to understand the correspondence theory. Suvira Jaiswal has shown that Varna caste system cannot be reduced to caste endogamy and hereditary labor division. In fact, all these traits of caste system evolved in a process due to social, economic and political changes. The ritualistic aspect of the caste system was determined in the last analysis by the socio-economic developments in the society. Otherwise, the caste system would have been temporally and spatially identical. But caste system is not identical temporally and spatially. I mean, you find different kinds of caste system in different parts of India, and even through ages, vertically also, you find numerous changes in the caste system. Even the ritualistic aspect of caste system changed through history. Whenever there was a correspondence between new production relations and class dynamics, the caste system became more consolidated and rigid. And whenever new production relations and class dynamics were not in congruence with the prevailing caste system and its hierarchy, its structural changes took place in the Varna caste system. This does not mean that caste Varna are class. Rather, except the point of origin, there is a relation of correspondence between them. We will come to this correspondence theory after a little while. At present, it suffices to say that the historical development of Varna caste system and its internal, temporal and spatial variations are due to its continuous dialogue and dialectics with class relations, and production system. Now let me dwell on the correspondence theory for a while. As we saw, at the point of origin, there was an overlapping between Varna and class. In other words, Varna represented the class division of early Vedic society. However, afterwards, a relation of correspondence developed between them. Why did it happen? The reason was a peculiar kind of ideological legitimation of the class hierarchy by the ideologues of the ruling class in the Vedic period. The role of these ideologues was played by the Brahmins, who were also part of the ruling class combined of Kshatriyas and Brahmins. This peculiar kind of legitimation can be characterized as religious ritualistic ossification of the labor division and class division prevailing in the later Vedic period. As we have seen, the principal characteristics of caste system, that is, caste endogamy and hereditary labor division, were not to be seen in the Varna system of the early Vedic period. These traits developed only with surplus production, class and state formation, and consolidation of patriarchy, as Suvira Jaiswal has rightly pointed out. Now, every ruling class in the history of the world has constructed an ideological justification for the class division and hierarchy, as well as labor division. However, in every known case, this ideological justification has taken a form that was temporally and spatially temporary and more dynamic. It was not fossilized or ossified in the religious codes as such. In the plains of Ganges, we witness a different and peculiar kind of ideological legitimation constructed for sustaining the class and Varna caste hierarchy by the ruling class in the later Vedic period. The social class division and labor division was religiously and ritualistically ossified. The ideological device of this ritualistic ossification was Brahmanism, which was based on the idea of purity and pollution. Consequently, this led to the disintegration of the overlapping between Varna and class, because Varna caste divisions assumed the religious, ritualistic and divine aura through religious codification and ritualistic ossification, and became relatively less dynamic than the real class relations. This ideological legitimation of class relations was bound to develop a higher relative autonomy from the real dynamic class relations in the course of time. This particularity led to a gap between the ossified form of previous class division of a bygone era and the new emerging class relation. The relation of overlapping was transformed into a relation of correspondence. This obviously does not mean that caste became completely independent and completely autonomous of class relation. The relationship of correspondence is evident from the fact that whenever there were radical changes in the production relations and class structure of society, tremors in the old ritualistic hierarchy could be felt, finally leading to disintegration, realignment, readjustment and restructuring of castes and their hierarchy. As we saw during our discussion of the history of origin of Varna caste system in the preceding paragraphs, all these changes in the ritualistic hierarchy were brought about by the same Brahmanical ideology based on purity and pollution. It can be said that the one relatively consistent feature of caste system is the Brahminical ideology showing a strong element of continuity, though the social and economic variables have kept changing through ages. The point that I want to make here, and to simplify the things, that Varna represented the class division of the early Vedic period, which was codified by the Brahmins as religious laws and rules. It was ritualistically ossified, just like a fossil of a dinosaur on a rock. So due to this ritualistic ossification and fossilization, the caste and Varna hierarchy, the complete overlapping, it was converted into a correspondence between caste and class. And since then, this relationship of correspondence has continued through ages, even during the rise of monotheistic sects like Buddhism and Jainism. I mean, though these sects challenged the Brahminical ideology or Brahminical theories on the plane of ideology, I mean, theoretically it challenged the Brahminical hegemony, ideologically it challenged the Brahminical hegemony. But as Irfan Habib, Satish Chandra, many other historians have pointed out, that Buddhism, on the one hand, while challenging Brahminical ideology on the plane of Brahminical hegemony, on the plane of ideology, it accepted the caste system as a reality of society. And that is why, in the lifetime of Buddha himself, the indebted landless peasants were not allowed to take pravrajya. They were not allowed to become the member of the order of monks, Buddhist monks. Women were not allowed to become monk without consent of their husband. Soldiers were not allowed to take pravrajya without the consent of the king, that is the state of that time. So, even in the time of Buddha, the Buddhist religion, it practically, for all practical purposes, it accepted the caste system as a reality of society. When Buddhism became a state religion, it declined much faster. So once Buddhism became a state religion, it declined in a much faster fashion. This period also coincided with the rise of certain Hindu sects, Vaishnava and Shaiva. That's why Max Weber once said that Hinduism is not a religion in the proper sense of the word. The reason for that is Hinduism is such a flexible and hegemonic religion that it is not based on dogma but doxa. So due to this hegemonic character of Hinduism, Brahminical ideology, it co-opted and sublated certain positive elements of different monotheistic sects during the period of Buddha, during the period of Bhakti movement, and different periods, whenever there was a challenge posed to Hinduism, it kind of sublated certain things and made itself much more hegemonic than before. So, when Vaishnav and Shaivite sects emerged, Buddhism declined, and final blow to Buddhism was the violent Brahminical reaction and reconquest of India, to which also Ambedkar alluded in some of his writings. But the violent reconquest was not the basic thing. The basic thing was that certain teachings of Buddha actually consolidated Varna system. Irfan Habib has written a famous article, Caste in Indian History. He makes a very valid point. He says that the Buddhist insistence on non-violence and the Buddhist theory of reincarnation and karma, these are two basic elements of Buddhism which actually consolidated caste system, because the occupations which were described as lowly due to the emphasis on these values of non-violence, karma and reincarnation were occupations of Dalit caste, outcaste. So actually their downgrading was actually, it received an impetus from the rise of Buddhism. And Jainism was much more conformist and reactionary as compared to Buddhism. I need not to go into detail of Jainism. The emergence of untouchability is another factor which must be understood. Emergence of untouchability ranges from around 700 BC to 1200 AD. The pioneering study on untouchability has been done by a historian named Vivekanand Jha. Vivekanand Jha argued that emergence of untouchability is umbilically linked with the emergence of feudal relations. Feudal relations made caste oppression very institutionalized, extreme in form, and barbaric. The Indian feudalism was different from European feudalism. For example, there is a debate about feudalism in India, whether there was feudal relations in India or not. Some people claim that since we didn't have any institution like serfdom, the Indian pre-capitalist mode of production cannot be characterized as feudalism. But they missed the simple point that here we didn't need any institutionalized serfdom, because unfree and servile labor was being supplied by Dalit castes, outcastes. So there was no need for a juridico-legal institution of serfdom, because the social institution, socio-economic institution of caste system was actually able to supply this servile and slave labor. Certain occupations, the need of the feudal ruling class to make the exploitation of, and oppression of certain castes as structural and extreme, they created this theory of untouchability, the theory of polluting work, polluting caste, and imposed untouchability on these castes. These castes included the outcasts as well as the Heen Shudra. For example, Chandalas, today we describe, the state describes them as Dalits, as outcasts. But actually Chandalas in the later Vedic period, they belonged to the Shudra world. Later they were downgraded to the status of untouchables and outcasts. Simply Chamas, Charmakara. If you follow the Vedic references, then you will find that Charmakaras were not a disreputable occupation, the job of cobblers and tanners. It was very respectable because it was obligatory to carry all the material of Vedic rituals in leather bags. So any work associated with leather bags or making leather was not looked down upon, but later they were pushed down into the hierarchy and converted into an outcast, untouchable caste. So if we study the evolution of untouchability, we must understand the origin of emergence of feudal relation. Now, caste system, untouchability, proliferation of Dalit castes, it continued to develop in the feudal period of India. In 11th century AD, Turkish invasion happens, and with Turkish invasion, the first Muslim rule, the Delhi Sultanate, was established in India. After that, Mughals came, the second Muslim rule was established in India. We also discuss in very brief the impact of Muslim rulers, Muslim rule on caste system. In North India, I am not sure about South India, but in North Indian references, there is only one Muslim observer which utters anything critical about caste system, Al-Biruni. And that Muslim observer did not belong to the ruling combined ruling class or composite ruling class of the Delhi Sultanate period. He was a mathematician, a traveler, and a scientist. So the only Muslim observer which utters anything critical about caste system is Al-Biruni. Apart from that, the first conqueror of the Sindh province, Irfan Habib has quoted him from a medieval source. He looked at caste system with jealousy. He said that we should have something like that. It is such a great way to keep the oppressed section in structural subordination. We don't have that kind of system. So all Muslim criticized, all Muslim observers and rulers, they criticized Hinduism on two accounts: polytheism and idol worship, not caste system. And that is why Muslim rulers never tampered with the mode of surplus extraction, the mode of feudal surplus extraction. Feudalism went through many changes in the Muslim period. For example, new composite feudal ruling class came into being with the institution of Iktadari, first in the Delhi Sultanate, then Jagirdari and Mansabdari during the Mughal period. And there was a composite ruling class comprising of Turkish element, Afghan element, Iranian element, and upper caste element. A composite feudal ruling class came into being, but at the grassroots level, the mode of surplus extraction from Shudra castes and Dalits was not tampered with. It was left as it is. So the Muslim rule also did not bring about any major change in caste system. Rather, caste system brought about a change in Islamic society by percolating and infiltrating the veins of Islamic society. We witnessed the rise of Kameen caste. Kameen means lowly in North India, and very ill read about South Indian history. But in North India, it led to creation of Kameen Jati. Kameen Jati included Bulkars, and doing some lowly, those Dalit converts into Islam who joined the fold of Islam, they were Dalits thereof, and it led to a proliferation of castes within the fold of Islamic society. If we talk about the British rule, after Mughal period, Britishers came, the impact of British rule on caste system is an issue of controversy, because many anti-caste reformers evaluated British rule having mainly positive impact on the Dalits. For example, Ambedkar, Periyar, and Phule only partially, because towards the end of his life, Phule was becoming more and more critical about colonial rule. Very few people know about it, because works of Phule are especially after 1881-82, the last 10 years of Phule, his works are not available in Hindi or English. Even the main writings of Phule from 1879, his testimony before Hunter Commission, Gulamgiri, or Cultivator's Whipcord, the translation is horrible. I mean, you have to make sense by your own intelligence of that translation, but you get the sense that Phule was becoming increasingly critical of British rule. I'll come back to that later. But in my opinion, the impact of British rule was mainly negative for the Dalits, for many reasons, but principally due to their land settlements. Now, there was a debate between English colonialists as to what kind of land settlement we should introduce in India. The debate was basically between followers of the physiocrats, Turgot, and these political economists, and utilitarians like Mill, followers of utilitarians. The physiocrats believed that we should introduce private property in land, because private property will give incentive to the landlords to develop productivity and develop agriculture, which will increase the revenue of the British colonial state. So the first land settlement was introduced by Lord Cornwallis in 1793, which was permanent settlement, and Lord Cornwallis was influenced by physiocrats, deeply influenced by physiocrats. The permanent settlement was the first settlement which created the juridico-legal category of private property in land in India for the first time. Before that, rulers, the state, the king, the Badshah or the Raja or the Sultan, he could have taken land from the Iktadars or Jagirdars or Mansabdars at will. But the English colonial state for the first time created private property in land, and who were the holders of this private property in land? The upper castes, Zamindars, were made the owners of the land in Bengal and United Province. In two provinces mainly, the permanent settlement was implemented. And in these two provinces, the landlessness of the Dalits, the landless Dalit labor and the poor Shudra semi-free peasant castes, their landlessness and their indebtedness, it was converted into a chronic and perennial landlessness and indebtedness. And due to this, the subordination of the Dalits, the landlessness of the Dalits, was converted into a very deeply ingrained perennial chronic structural thing. Even the most progressive land settlement, Rayatwadi settlement, which was implemented under the influence of utilitarians, and Mahalwadi settlement. In the Rayatwadi settlement, land was not given to the Dalit like this. Land was given to the middle peasant caste. For example, Jats in northwestern frontier, Jat peasantry, they were being sedentarized by the Turkish invader itself. Jats were for the first time sedentarized in the 12th century AD. They were brought from the northwestern frontier. They were kind of pastoral nomadic tribes. Also engaged in scavenging. Now, you can't say this thing in Haryana, you will be beaten, that actually Jats belong to a pastoral nomadic tribe roaming the northwestern frontier of Indian subcontinent, engaging in scavenging and other so-called glory professions. They were brought into the present state of Haryana, North Rajasthan and Punjab, and they were sedentarized. So, the Rayatwadi settlement gave land to these middle castes rather than Dalit landless. The Mahalwadi settlement gave land to the village community, which was headed by a village headman. In almost all cases, this village headman belonged to higher caste, which was reflected in the injustice committed against the Dalit landless, because in rotation system, allocation, rotational allocation of what Arjun Appadurai has called rise of the ethnographic state, this modernist colonial fetish with counting and categorizing the bodies, with knowing the Orient better so that it can be ruled in a better way. It led to many things. One, it starts with the establishment of Oriental Society of Bengal by William Jones in 1784. He recruits, on the one hand, he himself learns Sanskrit, William Jones, and he recruits Brahmins to translate all the sacred texts, Vedas, Upanishads, Purans, Brahmin Samhitas, and Brahmins translated these texts, and these texts became the foundation of colonial knowledge about the Orient. Many anthropologists have written about it, Bernard Edgecombe, Ronald Inden, Arjun Appadurai, many prominent sociologists and anthropologists have written about it. So this Brahminical knowledge became the foundation of colonial knowledge about India. How to rule India, how to see India, and how not to tamper with the social organization of India. So Britishers never tampered with the social organization of Indian society. They actually, you know, gave new force to the social structure. By the second step of the ethnographic state, beginning of caste-based census by H.H. Risley in 1881, that was the first time when the Dalits were defined in a legal and juridical sense with the invention of the category of scheduled caste. So the minimal possibility of social mobility in the Indian society was blocked by this creation of a juridical legal entity of scheduled caste. And this is how the British colonial state invented and reinvented the Orient after the image of its own modernist knowledge. And in this, it was greatly helped by the Brahmins and the clerics. Even Maoris were recruited to translate the sacred texts of Islam, Sharia, Quran. All of this was translated. The work was started in the late 18th century itself by the British colonial state, when it was still not under English crown but under East India Company. But their logic of governmentality was so clear and so lucid that they started the work right away. Now these two things consolidated the caste system in such a way that it has led certain subaltern historians to conclude that caste was a colonial construct. For example, Nicholas Dirks, he's a leading subaltern historian, he wrote a very famous book, Castes of Mind. In that book he argues that caste was a colonial construct. Now I don't agree with that logic, because if you say caste is a colonial construct, then you absolve the pre-colonial history of India, then you absolve pre-colonial Brahmanism of India. So caste definitely was not a colonial construct, but his argument is partially true in the sense that the British colonial state actually strengthened the caste system and made the position of Dalit landless even more vulnerable. So in this way, English colonialism strengthened the caste system and made the landlessness and vulnerable position of the Dalits even more perennial and chronic. Now there were some positive impacts of British rule also. For example, introduction of Western modern education and recruitment into army. Now this educational work has been done by Christian evangelicals as well as English colonial state. But as Anand Telutumbde has rightly pointed out in his book Mahar, his latest book Mahar, The Making of First Dalit Revolt. On the one hand, this thing was not done due to some kind of idea of benevolence towards or responsibility towards Indian society. It was the byproduct of certain policies of the colonial state which were formulated due to the political exigencies of the colonial rule in India. It was not the benevolent modernist character, the heirs of Tom Paine and Rousseau and Locke and Voltaire and Diderot. It was not due to that. It was the byproduct of certain political exigencies, number one. And number two, he has also rightly pointed out, given the geographical and political size of the entity called colonial India, this was minuscule. The work done by the Christian evangelical missionaries as well as the colonial state. And in most of the places, as you must be knowing, when the Brahmins protested the admission of Dalit children into the schools run by government, often the colonial state stopped that admission, because colonial state didn't want to lose its most loyal ally, landlord, feudal, Brahmin and Kshatriya class. That is why the recruitment into military also was stopped in 1891, and most of the anti-caste forums towards the end of 19th century were organized on the question of recommencement of recruitment into the army. For example, Vallandigam, who was one of the main influences of Ambedkar, Phagul Bansol, Kisan Phaguji Bansol, and many other anti-caste reformers in Maharashtra actually started agitation and social advocacy for start or recommencement of recruitment into the army. But the British state did not do it except for two brief interregnums, First World War and Second World War. And during the First World War and Second World War also, except Mahar Regiment, all the Dalit recruitment was done on non-combatant posts, not combatant posts. So the partisanship of colonial state was very clear. There were some positive byproducts of the colonial rule, there is no doubt about that. But they are minuscule, and as far as the intention of the colonial state was concerned, it was not for the upliftment of Dalits. It was the byproduct of other policy considerations. So, but there is another impact about which also Marx and Ambedkar also rightly commented, that blow to casteism can be done by industrialization and urbanization. Marx said, some people have misquoted Marx, that the development of industries and railways will lead to withering away of caste. Marx has never said that. Marx only said that economic registers of caste will decline with industrial capitalist development and urbanization. It doesn't mean that caste will go away automatically with the development of capitalism. And this misreading of Marx has led what D.D. Kosambi called official Marxists of India to wrong conclusion, to which Comrade Matthew also pointed out. I won't go into detail of that, but the limited, stunted industrial development and urbanization in the colonial India led to partial weakening of certain socio-economic registers of caste. But one thing that continued, persisted, and became even more strengthened, and it has kept becoming more and more strong throughout the history of the late 19th century, 20th century, and the early decades of 21st century, is caste endogamy. I will come to that later, why. But the commensal prejudices, untouchability and hereditary labor division, were slightly weakened during the colonial period, and after independence, when bourgeoisie came into power in India, it adopted a certain path of capitalist development. As far as agriculture is concerned, it adopted a path of land reforms, which can be called Prussian path of land reforms. In this Prussian path of land reforms, the ex-feudal lords were allowed to become capitalist farmers, yokers and kulaks. And in this way, the Dalit landless were again betrayed by the bourgeois state of independent India. Secondly, after Green Revolution, the mechanization and modernization, capitalist mechanization and modernization of agriculture was undertaken by the Indian state. But the beneficiaries of that, the result of that, was emergence of a class of rich tenant farmers, generally belonging to middle peasant caste. In North, Jat, a certain section of Yadavas, Kurmis, in South, Reddi, Kamma, these middle peasant castes were the main beneficiaries of this capitalist modernization of agriculture. Not the entire caste, a certain section of these castes. Marathas, certain section of these castes produced an elite class of rich tenant farmers. So, in the independent India also, with industrial development, and the industrial development also was of a peculiar kind. If you read Tata Birla Plan, there is already mentioned in Tata Birla Plan that we will start with state monopoly capitalism, and through state monopoly capitalism, we will allow the Indian bourgeoisie to stand on its feet through policies of import substitution, nationalization of bank, pooling of national saving, and then giving huge loans to the biggest corporate houses like Tata, Birla, Goenka, Thapar, the biggest corporate houses of that time. And these capitalist houses, their loans, which was given in the 1950s and 1960s, it was waived first by Chidambaram and then by the NDA government. And actually, that loan was the money of Indian people. And on the basis of that, Indian capitalist class stood on its feet after the 250 years of colonization. So all these, this peculiar kind of capitalist development did nothing for Dalits. And the Dalits remained landless, the Dalits remained vulnerable, oppressed as before, and new forms of oppression emerged with capitalism. The most barbaric forms of anti-Dalit atrocities, especially in the last 30-40 years. If you see at the data, you'll find that the most barbaric atrocities have been committed against Dalits of poor urban and rural families. You name the incident and you'll find it. Khairlanji, Mirchpur, Gohana, Bhagana, Jabkher, any case of anti-Lakshmanpur Bathe, Bathani Tola, all these anti-Dalit atrocities, who was the victim? So there is a clear-cut class character of Dalit oppression also involved. Whether we want to, whether we like it or not, that is the fact. There is a clear-cut class character of these incidents. It's true that all Dalits, at some point of time in their lives, they face some form of caste-based discrimination, some form of caste-based humiliation. But the most barbaric forms of caste-based oppression are reserved for the working class Dalits, rural or urban. Secondly, those Dalits who have now become part of the small section of Dalit elite class in India, they speak about it. They definitely pay lip service to annihilation of caste, but they are not willing to fight against it. That is why when there is an issue of renaming a university after a Dalit symbol, there is a huge hullabaloo. When there is a cartoon in an NCERT book, which must be fought, that is also an issue. Because on the symbolic plane also, we need to fight against caste-based oppression. But why the identity-based Dalit organization never raised such a hullabaloo when the murderers of Lakshmanpur Bathe are left clear-cut character here involved, the clear-cut method in this madness? So, I'll come to that later. But the point that I want to make that under capitalist development after independence, the two registers of caste, especially hereditary labor division, has weakened to a great extent, if not finished. Secondly, untouchability has declined to a considerable extent, if not finished. Commensal prejudices have declined to a certain extent, but not finished. Why? Because these traits or these registers of caste, they stand in contradiction with capitalist mode of surplus extraction. For example, if a Brahmin worker refuses to work on an assembly line which has been touched and worked upon by a Dalit laborer, the capitalist will throw him out. I am active in the Gurgaon Manesar industrial belt and I have seen it. No, the commensal prejudices and the hereditary labor division and untouchability, these registers have become weakened. But one register, which is the most important register, has become even stronger, caste endogamy. And the reason for that is that caste endogamy doesn't stand in any contradiction with capitalism. Caste endogamy makes private property even more sacred than classical political economists like Ricardo, Adam Smith, Bastiat and Carey and McCullough would have desired or imagined. So caste endogamy makes private property much more sacred than bourgeois ideologues. And that is why caste endogamy doesn't stand in any contradiction with capitalism, and that is why caste endogamy has been smoothly sublated and co-opted by the capitalist mode of production. And those registers of caste, which stood in contradiction with capitalist mode of surplus extraction, they decline in a gradual process. So this correspondence theory here also can be seen, that there is a correspondence between caste and class. In the last analysis, determined by changing dynamics of production relations and production system, I am not denying or in any way minimizing or belittling the question of caste. I am just trying to understand the interrelationship between caste. Otherwise, if we believe that caste system was engendered by Brahmin courts, then why we find so many variations spatially and temporally in the caste system? In Castes in India, Genesis, Mechanism and Development, Ambedkar's paper, Ambedkar says that Brahmins did not impose caste system on the Hindu society. Brahmins persuaded the rest of the Hindu society that their customs, their values and their traditions are superior and they should be This is a convention and invention of the Brahmins, which we call endogamy. So endogamy was practiced by Brahmins. Brahmins persuaded the rest of Hindu society to imitate their conventions and traditions. And that's how castes were created due to endogamy. But this is a circular logic. Brahmins had this convention or tradition of endogamy. They persuaded that their convention is superior. They persuaded the Hindu society to adopt endogamy, which led to proliferation of caste and consolidation of caste system. Then who created Brahmins? Then we'll have to rely on the Vedic sources that Brahmins were created by mouth of Brahma. So this is a circular path. I'll come to that later, the historiography of Ambedkar, because the critics have not understood that historiography of Ambedkar is not a writing of history. It's a political tract. It's a political exercise in identity construction and identity building. Anyway, so how does the capitalist class use caste today? In my opinion, I won't go into the metaphor of base and superstructure. Those who claim that caste belongs to superstructure don't understand caste, don't understand the history of caste. Caste began as labor division which got ritualistically ossified. It definitely crisscrosses the economic base also. In fact, and very interestingly, Ambedkar was the first person who emphasized that caste belongs to superstructure. In 1936-37, during the period of establishment of ILP, in one of his speeches, Ambedkar says that caste has nothing to do with access to economic resources. Translating it into Marxist terminology, caste doesn't belong to economic base. But Ambedkar had different intentions. When I discuss Ambedkar, I'll come to it. But capitalist class uses caste in differential ways. One is keeping the oppressed and exploited section divided into so many castes, to which Ambedkar also alluded. Here we also need to understand that because few people are today talking that for economic exploitation we need Marx, for social discrimination we need Ambedkar. In my opinion, those who extend this argument neither understand economic exploitation nor social oppression. Economic exploitation and social oppression seldom exist in isolated, pure archetypal form. Economic exploitation or social discrimination, these are abstractions to understand social phenomena. These represent the essential reality which hides behind the social phenomena. But at the level of social phenomena, you won't find classical economic exploitation as defined by Marx. Even Marx, when talking about the Irish workers and black workers, shows how different forms of social discrimination and economic exploitation were articulated and intertwined. And it holds true for all ages. Always social discrimination and economic exploitation in real social phenomena, they exist in an articulated and intertwined fashion. That is why capitalist class is enabled to use caste as a device to keep the exploited and oppressed sections of society in structural subordination. Second, the capitalist class itself uses caste division as a device to divide the extracted, appropriated surplus between the different blocks of the ruling class. Even the ruling class is organized along the caste lines. And whenever they fight or in their mutual rivalry for economic resources and political power, they actually use caste as a device for sharing of that political power and sharing of those economic resources. And economically, caste is still a partial regulator of distribution, a partial regulator of labor division. For example, recently in many cities, Valmiki, the sanitation workers' caste, it demanded that they should be given 100% reservation in sanitation work. No worker from any other caste should ever be recruited for sanitation work. Now, how do we explain this? We can explain this only through understanding the fact that few people, for example, say that caste is a feudal remnant, it's a feudal baggage. But if caste is a feudal remnant, how do you explain the existence of caste before the emergence of feudalism? Caste has been co-opted by different exploitative ruling classes It has been sublated by different exploitative ruling classes in their own way. What we are witnessing today is not a feudal remnant, it's a capitalist class system, a caste system. And unless and until we understand that, we cannot interpret these contradictory phenomena due to job insecurity created by capitalist mode of surplus extraction. A class of sanitation workers is demanding that this menial, so-called menial job should be reserved for them. Why? How? So, this historicity of caste must be understood in order to understand the contemporaneity of caste. Now, anti-caste movements before Ambedkar and during the time of Ambedkar. In my opinion, the most important anti-caste movement during the period of Ambedkar, overlapping with the period of Ambedkar partially, was the movement of Ayyangar. And believe me, I am not saying this because I am speaking in Kerala. I have made presentations on this issue in different cities of India and I have already maintained this, always maintained this, that the anti-caste movement of Ayyangar can teach a lot to the anti-caste movement of present India for two, three reasons. One is, Ayyangar was not a reformist. He might not have been a conscious materialist revolutionary. He was also inclined towards the spiritualist philosophy of Narayan Guru towards the end of his political career. But in practice, Ayyangar always repeatedly trespassed the legalities of the colonial state. He was not bothered about the legalities. The movement he started for the right to walk on public roads for Dalits, which ultimately culminated for Pulayas, which culminated in Cheriyar riots, has been rightly termed by Anand Tertumbre as the first armed rebellion of Dalits. And Ayyangar, in this way, two things. I think Ayyangar is very, very important. One, he was not a state-o-later and conformist. And for anti-caste movements of today, the trespassing the limits of bourgeois legality is very important. Trespassing the ambits of bourgeois legality is very important. And in this, Ayyangar teaches us a lot. Second, for anti-caste movement, Ayyangar mainly relied on the initiative of the people rather than the actions of the state, apart from the social advocacy that he did as a member of legislative council. He mainly relied on the initiative and organization of the people rather than the affirmative action of the greatest mediator, the state. So in these two senses, I think Ayyangar is very important for present day anti-caste movement. The second important figure in my opinion is Jyotiba Phule. Jyotiba Phule, the main writing, the most famous writing is Gulamgiri, in which he exposes Hinduism in such a witty fashion that everybody should read it. But in this work, he sees colonial British power as the liberator of Dalits. He also creates certain myths. For example, Jesus was actually Raja Bali. Raja Bali who went there, he was Jesus Christ. So he sees in colonial state the personification of Western modernity ideals of Ripley. So he was very hopeful about the role of colonial state. But towards the end of his life, Phule is becoming more and more critical about colonial state. For example, in his testimony to the Hunters Commission, he says that despite the fact that Brahmins are such a reactionary force, why the colonial state is aligned with the Brahmins and giving them preference in recruitment to their bureaucracy and education. Then again, in 1881, after 2 years, he writes a book called Cultivator's Whipcord, and he goes to the extent of saying that the blood of a colonial administrator and the blood of a Brahmin is same. Last three chapters were such trenchant critique of British colonialism that one of his disciples, Lokhande, refused to publish it in an edition of writings of Jyotiba Phule, edited by him, and Jyotiba Phule was very annoyed with this. So I hadn't read Phule's writing after 1881, but the trajectory is simple, the trajectory is clear. The trajectory of Phule's thought, it was becoming more and more anti-colonial because Phule was able to see the link between Brahminical ideology, the Brahminism, and the colonial state. And this is a great contribution of Phule in my opinion. it doesn't really matter if towards the end of his life he became a consistent anti-colonialist or not. But the approach and trajectory of Phule's thought is very clear. He is not afraid or ideologically obligated not to think something. He is free to think anything, and that is why there is a free evolution of Phule's thought towards the end of his life. The third important figure was Pariyar. I won't go into detail of Pariyar, but this much can be said, that Pariyar's critique of caste can be reduced to critique of religion. So if you do away with religion and God, you can do away with caste. Later he descended into Dravidian nationalism and identity politics, but his critique of caste also is partial. It is true that without doing away with religion, without doing away with religion, without materialistic and atheistic propaganda, you cannot annihilate caste. But that is only partially true, because it is very likely to come across an atheist who is a casteist, who follows all the caste norms. So it is not only about religion. So that was the main weakness of Pariyar's analysis of caste. But no doubt, he was one of the most consistent materialist and rationalist of 20th century. There is no doubt about that. The philosophy and politics of Ambedkar is very important to understand for present anti-caste movement. Now, first we should talk about contributions of Ambedkar. In my opinion, there are two principal contributions of Ambedkar. One, he established a sense of dignity, a sense of self-respect among the Dalits. That is his big contribution. Second, he established the question of caste on the national agenda with unprecedented and unique emphasis. Obviously, in both these things, many people contributed. Iyengar contributed, Phule contributed, Pariyar contributed, even communists contributed. Despite not understanding caste, empirically they fought against caste, especially till 1951, if you talk about CPI. They were involved in all the struggles of landless peasantry. It was their simplistic understanding or lack of understanding of caste system which prevented them from presenting a complete program for annihilation of caste. But this failure is not isolated failure. We are talking about the Communist Party, which was formed in 1925 and continued to function without a central committee till 1933, which continued to function without a general secretary till 1936, and which continued to function without a program of Indian Revolution till 1951. They adopted a program after a delegation of CPI met with a delegation of the Soviet Party comprising of Molotov and Stalin, and after returning from there, based on the remarks of the Soviet delegation, they may adopted a program of People's Democratic Revolution. So intellectually and politically, the Communist Party of India was very weak from the beginning. And it has its own historical reason why it was weak. I cannot go into detail on that. But the communists empirically fought against caste throughout their political activism, till 1951 especially. For example, in Kisan Mahasamad, on the party forum of 1930, they adopted a resolution on elevation of caste. On the forums of trade unions in 1940s, mid-1940s, late-1940s, they adopted special resolutions for working on the question of caste. And empirically, they were involved in all those struggles which were being fought by Dalit landless people, be it Punapra Vailar, be it Telangana, be it Tebhaga. All these peasant revolts were actually revolts of poor Shudra peasant caste and landless Dalit. So empirically, they raised the question of caste as a part of their struggle against feudalism. But this kind of anti-caste struggle was empirical at best. And this empirical struggle against caste doesn't suffice. But this failure of Communist Party is part of a broader failure. A party which works for 26 years without a program. So, did they have a special program for gender? Did they have a special program for language problem? Did they have a special program for nationalities problem? No, they didn't. Contingently and empirically they took positions, but only contingently and empirically. So it's a broader failure, I won't go into the detail. But Ambedkar was in this sense His contribution is important because he established caste question on the national agenda with unprecedented emphasis, and he created the sense of self-dignity among Dalits. Now, few words on how not to criticize Ambedkar. Some people have criticized Ambedkar for inconsistency in his political thought and political theory. Ambedkar had replied to these critics in his lifetime. He said that consistency is virtue of an ass. Consistency gadhe ki khasiyat hoti hai. So consistency is a virtue of an ass. Because if we study closely the political career of Ambedkar, we find a consistent inconsistency of pragmatism. He is very consistent in his inconsistencies. So, second, some people have tried to analyze Ambedkar on the basis of analysis of his intentions. In my opinion, social scientists should never talk about intentions. Whether Ambedkar was opportunist or not, whether Ambedkar lacked integrity, these are not relevant questions. Ambedkar never took anything quid pro quo for his personal gains. What he did was his political conviction. Now, we should start the analysis of any political figure, any political party or any political movement by analyzing the philosophical outlook of that person, party or movement. What was the philosophical origins of Ambedkar? What was his world outlook? And that is the basic question which should be dealt with. His basic philosophical position was the same as Deweyan pragmatism. John Dewey was one of his teachers in Columbia University along with Seligman and Schottler. And he had a defining impact on Ambedkar. For example, one of the disciples of Ambedkar, K.M. Kadam, has rightly commented that you can't understand Ambedkar if you don't understand Dewey. His wife, Ambedkar's wife, Savita Ambedkar, told Eleanor Theriot, who is a scholar very sympathetic to Ambedkar, that Ambedkar, after 30 years of sitting in the classroom of John Dewey, was happy to imitate the classroom mannerisms of John Dewey. Similarly, many other observers have shown beyond any doubt that Ambedkar has strong impact of Deweyan pragmatism. He was a committed Deweyan pragmatism. I won't go into the history of development of pragmatist philosophy in America. It is there in the paper. You can read it in the paper. What were the basic tenets of Deweyan pragmatism? In my opinion, there are six characteristic features of Deweyan pragmatism. The first assertion of Deweyan pragmatism is that there can be no general theory or principle of natural or social phenomena. In other words, there can be no generalization of any sort. Pragmatism has a natural antipathy to theory. The reason for this animosity to generalization is that according to Deweyan pragmatism, no causation of phenomena is possible. Therefore, what we can do is follow a scientific laboratory method of observing, recording, and on the basis of these, develop a tentative idea for immediate action. If this plan of action is validated practically, then one must hold on to it. Otherwise, again make an observation. On the basis of that observation, develop a tentative idea leading to a plan of action, and so on. As we can see, there is a method fetishism in Deweyan pragmatism coupled with a natural antipathy to theory. According to Dewey, there is no need for critical evaluation of previous practice because past does not create present, as there is no causation. One can hear the echo of Emerson here. Emerson was Kantian transcendentalist philosopher of America. Only pragma, no dogma. Only practice, no dogma. No approach, only the scientific method of progressive experimentation. Dewey's central assertion of Deweyan pragmatism is that any change or development in society or nature is always incremental and gradual. This theme of Deweyan pragmatism was developed under the influence of Darwin's evolutionism. As you might recall, Darwin had once remarked, there are no leaps in nature. According to Dewey, there are no leaps in the social or natural development, and all change takes place incrementally and gradually. Consequently, there can be no revolutionary change in society. All change in the society must be incremental. As we can see, pragmatism is fundamentally opposed to the very idea of revolutionary change. If we translate the philosophy of Dewey pragmatism into politics, it naturally results in the liberal bourgeois reformist politics of the Fabians and later the Labour Party type political formation. The impact of these brands of politics on the political thought and practice of B.R. Ambedkar. There is no cause-effect relation between past and present. For a pragmatist, it is useless to review or sum up the failure of the past experiment. What one is required to do is start scientific observation anew, develop a tentative idea again, and on the basis of that derive a plan of action, and then plunge into action. Progressive experimentation ad infinitum. The fourth important characteristic of Deweyian pragmatism is implicit in his idea of society. What is society for Dewey? It is not constituted by dialectical relations between different social strata. To view society as divided into different strata based on the access to economic, social and political power, or in Marxist terminology, to view society divided into classes, it is essential to perform a generalization of social relations. However, due to his anathema to causation and generalization, Dewey refrains from seeing society as constituted by social relations, which in turn are constituted by logic of contradiction. For Dewey, society is a collection of disparate groups. If you read Annihilation of Caste, you'll find these last two assertions made by Ambedkar also. These groups might include from a trade union, an association of industrialists, to a club, a baseball team, or a political party. So a collection of disparate groups. Dewey uses the term group not conceptually, but in a descriptive and generic fashion. For Dewey, there are no real contradictions in society. All the contradictions exist on the plane of idea, on the plane of perception. So there is no real contradiction between capitalists and workers, or between any social groups. And these perceived contradictions can be resolved by the mediation of the great mediator or the most rational agent. And this brings us to the next and most important characteristic of Deweyian pragmatism. The fifth important argument of instrumentalism of Dewey is that the state is the most rational actor in society. It is the great mediator. So all changes take place on the basis of what the state thinks and how the state acts. So state will take affirmative action to resolve the perceived contradictions in the society between different social disparate social groups. There can be no change from below by the collective action of the people, because any action from below results in use of force and violence. And for Dewey, violence is a waste. So any change should be brought about by the most rational actor. This thing, he takes it from Hegel and Kant. For Hegel, the state was the embodiment of reason. For Kant also. And he also borrows this Dewey from the classical theorist of bourgeois state, Locke and Rousseau, social contract theory. So state will resolve all the perceived contradiction. He will take affirmative action to resolve these perceived contradictions. There can be no change from below. The sixth and last important assertion of Deweyian instrumentalism was that there is a need of an ethical and humanist religion. He wrote an article in 1897 called Common Faith. All the perceived contradictions in society cannot be resolved by the state's intervention or the affirmative action of state. For example, in individual-to-individual relationship, an egalitarian relationship can be established only on the basis of religion. And that is why Dewey, as well as Ambedkar, said that all civil societies are based on a humanist religion. Without religion, there can be no civil society. So that is why his strategy of conversion. Now these six tenets of Deweyian pragmatism can be seen in the strategies employed by Dr. Ambedkar from 1916 up till 1956. The first strategy of Ambedkar was constructing a unitary identity for Dalits and Shudra castes, the OBCs. For this, if you read, because Ambedkar understood, and rightly so, that caste is a system of graded inequality. Shudra is oppressed by the Brahmins and Kshatriyas, but he is not willing to fight against Brahmins and Kshatriyas because he enjoys certain privileges vis-a-vis the Dalits. So he is oppressed by Brahmins, but he won't fight against Brahmins. Similarly, Vaishya, they won't fight against Brahmins and Kshatriyas because they enjoy certain privilege as compared to the Dalits and Shudras. And that is why this graded inequality prevents the laboring masses or the oppressed masses from getting united and fighting against Brahminical domination. And for that they needed one unitary identity. And that unitary identity Ambedkar tried to create throughout his life, mainly through three of his works. The first paper, Caste, Genesis, Mechanism and Development, in that he says that caste was created, as I mentioned, by Brahmins. Brahmins did not impose caste system, they persuaded the society to believe that their custom and tradition is superior, and their custom and tradition was endogamy, and endogamy thus became the tradition of the Hindu society, which led to proliferation and consolidation of caste. In Who Were the Shudras, published in 1947, he says that Shudras were actually Kshatriyas. Certain Kshatriyas were downgraded by the Brahmins due to the fact that these Kshatriyas had attacked Brahmins. So Brahmins in retaliation downgraded them just by denying them Upanayan Sanskar. What is it called in Malayalam? Upanayan Sanskar is the twice born, Janeu, you know, the ceremony which gives you the status of a twice born. So they denied Upanayan Sanskar to certain Kshatriyas and they became Shudra. So they have to regain that status. Who are Shudra? So he creates an identity for Shudras. He creates an identity for untouchables also. In untouchables, who are they and how they became untouchable? In which he says that all ancient communities at some point of time were conquered by invading tribes. Those tribes which were vanquished, they disintegrated and they became broken men. They started roaming here and there. And these broken men, actually in India also, we witness this phenomenon. These broken men became the first followers of Buddha when Buddha started teaching in 6th century BC. These broken men were later sedentarized by the caste Hindus on the periphery of village to defend themselves from the unconquered tribes. When Buddhism was defeated by Brahmanism, these broken men did not return to Hinduism and they clung to their Buddhist identity and they kind of boycotted the Brahmins from their social, cultural and religious ceremonies, and that is why Brahmins imposed the identity of untouchables on Dalits. So Dalits or untouchables, this identities, their identities reconstructed by a narrative of their being the most primitive followers of Buddha, who continued to be followers of Buddha, and that is why they were made into untouchables. Now, historiographically, these writings are incorrect. You won't find archaeological or literary evidence to support the theories about caste, untouchability, or origin of Shudra of Ambedkar. But these were political tracts. These were political writings. This was a political strategy to build a unitary identity for Dalits and Shudras. Towards the end of his life, Gail Omwell has written, he was constructing a grand theory of caste, in which he said that before the Islamic or British conquest of India, there was a Hindu conquest of Buddhist India, and there was a strong racial ethnic tone to his theory. So he was constantly trying to build a unitary identity for Shudras and Dalits, so that numerically they are the majority. If you add Shudra caste and Dalits, they are the majority of Indian population. So he tried to build that identity for them. The second strategy of Ambedkar was in the arena of electoral and social politics. Ambedkar's intervention in the arena of electoral politics starts with his testimony to the South Buru Committee, which had come to India in 1990 to define the electoral franchise on communal basis. It was precursor of Montfort reforms. Ambedkar represented the Dalit community as the most educated person from that community. Ambedkar had returned from the US, though he would leave again for London to continue his studies. In his testimony, Ambedkar argues that the real cleavage of the Hindu society is not between Brahmins and non-Brahmins, but between touchables and untouchables. The untouchables constitute a separate community entitled for communal court. So he demanded reserved seats or separate electorates from South Buru Committee. He forms Bahishkrit Hitkarini Sabha in 1923-24, and in 1927 he presents another set of proposals to Simon Commission, And here we witness a small change. He says either separate electorate or reserved seats with universal franchise for Dalits. Reserved seats were given to Dalits by Simon Commission. But Simon Commission said that the Dalit candidates will have to get their competence certified by the governor of the province. So it was like denying the right. So Ambedkar was irked from this statement of Simon Commission. But he refused to go against the state, because the basic idea of union pragmatism was not to go against the state. So he was annoyed with this, but he didn't oppose or confront the state on this question. Anyway, Simon Commission's report remained a dead letter, because Congress, the biggest party, was not part of the negotiation. And that is why Simon Commission kind of failed, which led to the round table conferences of 1931 and 1932. In those conferences also, there was no resolution. Ambedkar was there, Gandhi was there in the second conference, but no resolution was there. So British state, on its own initiative, gave separate electorate to Dalits. But Gandhi started his fast in Pune, Yerwada prison, and ultimately he said that no separate electorate, because it will divide the Hindu society. So Ambedkar debated with him, but ultimately Ambedkar surrendered before him. And he accepted Gandhi's formula of 148 reserved seat rather than 73 separate electorate. The reason for this, quoted by many people, is that Ambedkar feared that if something happens to Gandhi due to fast and to death, then there will be a Brahminical reaction against the Dalits. But Christopher Jacquemart has shown that that was not the principal reason. The principal reason for surrender of Ambedkar was the fact that more Dalits at that time were standing behind Gandhi as compared to the number of Dalits standing behind Ambedkar. And that is why the main Dalit leaders supported Gandhi in this. For example, Raja from Tamil Nadu and many other even close colleagues of Ambedkar started to support the demand of Gandhi. And ultimately Ambedkar gave his assent and accepted the formula of Gandhi. In between, what happens was the most important movement of Ambedkar, the Mahad Satyagraha, the Mahad movement. Now, in the Mahad movement, the first depressed classes communist with exceptional organizational skills, the idea of such a conference was incubated in 1924. It was decided that the conference should be presided by Dr. Ambedkar and he should be felicitated for his academic achievements. Ambedkar in the beginning did not agree to be a part of the conference. Anand Teltumbde has cited a number of sources who have given different reasons for that. One was the fact that Ambedkar was not assured about the capabilities of R.B. Moray. When a comrade in arms of Ambedkar, Kamalakant Chitre, assured him about his capabilities, Ambedkar began to consider his participation. Secondly, the son of Bhai Chitre, another close comrade of Ambedkar, S.V. Chitre, claims that Ambedkar in the beginning declined to be a part of the conference because he wanted to be a district judge and avoid political activities that might involve direct action. Teltumbde argues that it is unlikely that Ambedkar declined the proposal on this basis. However, this much is clear that unlike Ambedkar's earlier reform activities, this conference proposed some direct action which Ambedkar wanted to avoid. Anyhow, in the end, Ambedkar did participate and preside over the conference. Bhai Chitre has written that it was him and another comrade in arms of Ambedkar, Babu Sahasrabuddhe, who persuaded him to accept the proposal. Now, in the first conference, I will quote Ambedkar's address, because in this address, Ambedkar clearly shows his union pragmatism. And I quote, "There is another reason also for why I say that the untouchables should adopt white-collared profession." Now Ambedkar says, and I quote, "The government is the most important and powerful institution. The manner in which the government thinks makes things happen. However, we must not forget that what the government wants depends entirely on government employees. The mind of the government is basically the mind of its employees. One thing clearly follows from this, which is that if we want to get something of our interest through the government, we must get ourselves into government service. Otherwise, the kind of neglect we suffer today will continue forever. Without that, the untouchables will never attain their state of vigor." Again, in the same address, Ambedkar says, and I quote, If these educated boys and girls of untouchable community had reached the ranks of Mamlatdar, collector and magistrate today, they would have constituted an armored shelter over the entire untouchable community. Under its protective cover, all of us would have made progress. But in its absence, we are living under the hot sun and getting scorched. I am fully convinced that unless we create this protective cover over ourselves, we will not achieve our development. Similarly, he says that we should adopt farming. And for farming, where would the Dalits get land from? He doesn't demand land reforms. What he says, and I quote, "It may perhaps be difficult for the untouchables to purchase farmlands, but there are many fallow pieces, waste land, belonging to the forest department. They may be available if they, Dalits, make a request for them." So even when he proposes that Dalits should take farming, he doesn't demand land reforms and confiscation of feudal lands. He says that there are fallow and waste lands and we should ask the colonial government to give those lands to us so that we can start farming. Because he never wanted a confrontational approach towards the government. Again, the first conference ended by implementing the Borle Resolution of 1923, which said that the Dalits should be allowed to drink water from water public water bodies, walk on public roads, enter temples, etc. So the conference ended by drinking water from Chavdar Talab of Mahad. While returning, Dalits were attacked. Everybody knows that story. Marathas and mainly Marathas attacked Dalits. They were incited by a Brahmin priest of a temple, but they were attacked by Marathas. And after this attack, the Dalits were ready to retaliate. When Ambedkar returned to his dark bungalow where he was staying, Dalits were standing there. They were in thousands. Mahad Taluka was very small, and the Maratha population was very small as compared to the Mahars who were assembled in the conference. They were ready to retaliate, but Ambedkar stopped them from retaliating and rather took the path of legal action against the attackers. This experience prompted Ambedkar to hold a satyagraha in the same year. In December, he held a satyagraha, but in the end, he didn't culminate the satyagraha, he didn't organize the satyagraha, and he retreated. Why did he retreat? He retreated because the Marathas and the caste Hindus had taken an injunction from the court against the Dalits that they should not be drinking water from Chavdar Talab, because Chavdar Talab is a public, is a private property. The colonial court gave that injunction, that stay, in one day. Then the collector of the British came to the Pandal of Second Conference of Mahad. He threatened the Dalits assembled there that if you break the law, if you take law into your hands, then I will act against you. He threatened them in thinly veiled terms, the collector. And then he returned. Ambedkar had a meeting with collector before that, in which Ambedkar had given his agreement that the satyagraha will not be organized. But Ambedkar did not make this decision open in the second conference. So Ambedkar said that we will hold satyagraha, but you have to give me assurance that if the police cracks down, you are ready to go to jail or you are ready for even martyrdom. 10,000 Mahars raised their lathis and they said that we are ready to go to jail, we are ready for martyrdom. When we were leaving for this satyagraha, we wiped off the sindoor from the foreheads of our wives, we are ready for anything. Then Ambedkar said that, look, I am not satisfied with verbal assurance, you must fill a form, a prior consent form, that if you are willing to take this risk, you are willing to take the risk of being jailed, you are willing to take the risk of becoming a martyr. So he started, he got the activists filling up the forms. At 3500, the activists stopped filling up satyagraha. Then Ambedkar called a meeting of activists and decided not to hold satyagraha. Next morning, he delivered a speech in which he said that, and I quote, "If we do satyagraha today, it would go against the government. The government has sympathy for us. Then why should we put the government in dilemma unnecessarily? Next, you see that the touchable people do not have any sympathy for our satyagraha. We have to survive through this trap of injustice and oppression. For this kind of survival, we need cooperation from the government. There is nothing wrong if someone says doing satyagraha against the government is not proper, while the government is giving assurance of such cooperation. Then Ambedkar said that I was only checking your preparedness. Now that I have checked and realized that you are prepared and you have the strength and courage to do the satyagraha, there is actually no need to do the satyagraha. I was only checking your preparedness. And that's how the satyagraha ended into a non-starter, an anti-climax. There was no satyagraha. Similarly, in Nashik temple entry movement, he was invited by certain organizers in 1930 to lead the Nashik temple entry movement. Earlier he declined, then ultimately he went there. When the government clearly said, the collector clearly said that we are not going to support this assertion of civil and democratic rights by Dalits through direct action. If the Dalits try to enter temple, then we will crack down on Dalits. It was the stand of colonial government. So 20,000 Dalits marched, they sat outside the temple, but Ambedkar could not persuade the administration to be pro-Dalit. On the Ram Navami day in April, next month, in 1930 itself, there was a procession, there was a rath which was being pulled by people, and Dalit wanted the right to hold a rope to push that rath. When Dalit actually held that rath, the police cracked down on the orders of the colonial British police officers. But Ambedkar wrote a letter to the governor complaining about this incident of violence, and he says that, and I quote, "But the immediate cause of the fight was the action of the police sepoys, a great majority of whom were caste Hindus. They at once started to assault those untouchables who were struggling to hold a bit of the rope. The fight was started by the caste Hindu police, who openly took the side of touchable Hindus." And he then clearly makes that I am not complaining about the police officer, British police officer. They were doing their duty. They were just performing their duty. But I am complaining only against the caste Hindus who are part of the police force. Here also Ambedkar clearly avoids confrontation with the British colonial government. Now people have interpreted this as opportunism. But this is not opportunism. This is opportunism as far as the liberal bourgeois ideology of pragmatism is an opportunist bourgeois theory. But Ambedkar personally, honest or dishonest, opportunist or unopportunist, this is not the issue of for any social scientist. Definitely personally, he was not an opportunist. He was genuinely committed to the deviant pragmatist idea that we should not go against the government. Even during the experiment of ILP, because reserved seats were given and separate electorates were not given, he formed Independent Labour Party, because in reserved seats you have to have a broad social base rather than only Dalit social base. So he formed Independent Labour Party, in which he said that Dalits and oppressed, Dalits were not mentioned separately. The working masses of India are faced with two enemies, Brahmin Shahi and Bhandwal Shahi. That means Brahminism and capitalism. But in his personal speeches, he clearly said of the same period that caste has nothing to do with access to economic resources. So ILP was only an electoral strategy for reserved seats. Because on 148 reserved seats, if Ambedkar had to fight the election, he must have a broader social base apart from the Dalit masses. So he formed a new identity, a new political entity through ILP, only as a political strategy, electoral strategy. Some people have interpreted that Ambedkar was inclining towards Marxism. That is wrong. Ambedkar made it clear at that time also that he has no affinity for Marxism. Only during organizing some peasants and workers during the agitation to end the Khoti system and Vatan system, he said that on this question, we stand closer to Marxism. But except that, he made it clear time and again that he has no affinities with Marxism. So Ambedkar would have been the first person to refute it had he been alive. The many left Ambedkarites claim, Ambedkarite leftists claim that Ambedkar was slowly going towards Marxism in the 1930s and early 1940s. That's not true. Ambedkar clearly refutes this argument. So the third strategy, I mean the electoral strategy of Ambedkar, then ILP lost elections, struck them as territorial majorities. Obviously this was very impractical proposal. The colonial government didn't pay heed to these proposals, this proposal in particular. So Ambedkar was kind of sidelined during the 1940s by the colonial government also in negotiations about independence and how to the modalities of granting independence. Ambedkar was not invited as a party. Muslim League and Congress were. So also because Ambedkar was part of Viceroy's council, he was member of labor there, and as a member of labor he contributed many things. For example, he introduced an Indian Trade Union Amendments Bill in 1944, which obliged every factory owner to recognize a trade union in his factory. He secured reserved seats in British Technical College for Dalit students. So he actually contributed some things, but that is the limit of union pragmatism. That's the highest limit that union pragmatism can achieve. So the third strategy was collaborating with the rulers. And Ambedkar, especially from late 1930s, early 1940s, began to openly collaborate with the state. First, he became member of Defence Advisory Council, which the British had organized to involve Indian soldiers in the Second World War. And then he became a member of Viceroy's Council, member of Labour. And after independence, he became the Law Minister of Nehru government. He was co-opted into the Constituent Assembly and made the chairman of Drafting Commission on the insistence of Gandhi. In fact, Gandhi insisted that because the seat from which Ambedkar was elected went to East Pakistan, so one Congress member of parliament vacated his seat for Ambedkar. Ambedkar became member of parliament from there, and then he was co-opted into the Constituent Assembly and made the chairman of Drafting Commission. Ambedkar himself had written to one of his disciples, his colleagues, Dada Saheb Gaikwad, that no person with self-respect would ever collaborate with the Congress. But Ambedkar did collaborate with the Congress. Why? Because it was a dubious strategy of collaborating with the rulers. The state was the most rational actor. If the British were at the helm of the affairs in the state, Ambedkar collaborated with the British. When the Congress was at the helm of the affairs in the state, Ambedkar collaborated with the Congress. Because it was one of the basic ideological assertions or prejudices of the deviant pragmatism. And finally, the last strategy, I'm not going into details, I've taken a lot of time. Ambedkar drafted constitution, he played a dual role there. On the one hand, all these draconian laws were incorporated into the constitution. Because Ambedkar had to function in the space given by the bourgeois ruling class. And he could not go against the state because his central assertion was that government is the most rational, most powerful institution in society, and any change in society is dependent on the action of government. So these are not examples of opportunism. It only shows that Ambedkar was a consistent deviant pragmatist. That any ideology, any theory which prevents the working class, poor Dalits, and 89% of Dalits are still working class, that is, they belong to the urban and rural working classes. Any ideology or theory which prevents Dalits and the working masses from going against the state, any ideology which obliges the working masses and the working classes and Dalits to remain within the ambit of bourgeois legality is not effective for anti-caste struggle. Any ideology which reduces the entire anti-caste movement to advocacy for changes, to petitioning the government and remaining within the ambit bourgeois legalities of the bourgeois state, it is not going to work for today's anti-caste movement. What we need today is a non-identitarian, class-based anti-caste movement. That is, in my opinion, should the logic of identities othering. You cannot consolidate one identity without at the same time consolidating other identities in general and the polar opposite identity in particular. So if you consolidate, for example, the identity of Muslim to oppose the religious fundamentalism of Hindutva forces, you only strengthen them. For example, what Marx said about the Jewish problem in Europe, the solution of the problem is that stop being Jew. That is the solution. So, even in the case of resolution of the caste question, if we strengthen the identities to erect an anti-caste movement, it won't lead us anywhere. Because the othering process involved in identity formation and consolidation will always prevent that movement from becoming subversive, going beyond the limit of the system. And that is why, in my opinion, the anti-caste movement of today should be an anti-class-based anti-caste movement. For example, it can be understood by this statement: every Dalit faces some form of social discrimination at some point of his life. But the most brutal and barbaric forms of caste-based oppression are reserved for the working class Dalits that constitute 89-90% of total Dalit population. Every worker faces economic exploitation, but the Dalit worker faces super exploitation due to the excess of his vulnerable social location. So in this way, economic exploitation and social discrimination are always intertwined, and they are articulated. And to fight social discrimination as well as economic exploitation today, for the annihilation of caste also, we need an anti-caste movement based on class. It's true that even Mayawati faces caste-based humiliation. Recently, a BJP leader abused Mayawati, hurled casteist abuses against Mayawati. But Mayawati, the leader of BSP, did not, take to streets against Brahmanism. It was a blessing in disguise, because any kind of such incident will consolidate the Dalit vote bank of Mayawati on the basis of identity politics. So the caste-based discrimination, the humiliation of even elite Dalits or upper middle class Dalits happens, but they won't fight against it. They are umbilically linked with the system. And what Malcolm X said about slaves, how slaves actually became supporters of white supremacy and white capitalism, it also applies to all oppressed communities of the world, be it blacks or Dalits or oppressed nationalities. There is always a small elite section erected from the oppressed communities by the ruling classes, which elite ruling classes building a class-based anti-caste movement. I cannot go in further detail, the paper will be distributed. I would like to end on this note that an anti-caste movement must take into account certain questions. The first question that it needs to take into account, the first question is raising the questions of caste as atrocities and fighting against Brahminical domination. The priority of the issues that caste-based anti-caste movement will determine will be based on the class priority. So the first priority is fighting against caste-based atrocity. We have formed an Akhil Bharatiya Jati Virodhi Manch in North India, and we actually organized a movement in which we organized people on the basis of class, and we fought against certain incidents of caste-based atrocity, and in some of the movements also became successful. So first of the most important issue is anti-Dalit atrocities today, on which most of the identity politicians are silent. They are only raising ahula balu on the symbolic issues rather than the real issues. So the most important priorities of class-based anti-Dalit anti-caste movement will be determined by class priorities. And on that note, I would like to finish this paper. I think it will be distributed to remaining people. And also, I think this paper should be given to A.F. Matthews also. Thank you.